It's 2 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Kingston, Ontario.
Good afternoon. Really good to see you. Really good to see you here. Yeah. Excellent. So, yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Mohammed Kimji. I'm the David Allgood Professor in Business Law at Queen's University. On behalf of our law school, I want to start by acknowledging that Queen's University is situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory. We are grateful to live and work on these lands. It's my pleasure to welcome everyone to the third annual Marcus Matalon Lecture in U.S. Law. Our speaker is Akhil Reed Amar, the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. The title of his talk is The U.S. Constitution and the Law of the Land, Maps, Militaries, and the Mississippi. In a moment, I'm going to turn it over to Stephen to introduce Professor Amar. But before I do, I just wanted to say that this is one of my favorite events of the year at Queen's, and it's because this gift that Stephen and Renee have given to the school have given me opportunities to connect with incredible scholars like Professor Amar, who I would otherwise not have the opportunity to connect with because we work in completely different areas. And it's a real pleasure to work with Stephen and Renee to plan this event every year. And so now I'm going to turn it over to introduce Professor Amar.
Renee and I want to thank Queen's Law School for hosting the Marcus Matalon Lecture Series on U.S. Law. We also want to thank you, Professor Kimji, for organizing the lecture. These lectures would not be possible without you, and it's a pleasure to work with you. This lecture series is intended to help Queen's Law students develop a basic understanding of the U.S. institutional system, which may be useful to you when you become practicing lawyers working in a transnational legal environment. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker today, Professor Akhil Reed Amar of Yale Law School. Professor Amar is a graduate of college, in Yale Law School. He became a professor of law at Yale Law School in 1985, and is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School and at Yale College. Professor Amar has been cited by U.S. Supreme Court justices in four dozen cases. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. And has written articles appearing in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, and The Atlantic. He is the author of over 100 law review articles and several books on U.S. constitutional law, including most recently, The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840. As Professor Kimji said, Professor Amar's lecture today is titled The U.S. Constitution as the Law of the Land, Maps, Militaries, and the Mississippi. And one aspect of the lecture will be international borders between the United States and its neighbors. Professor Amar, thank you for traveling across an international border between Canada and the United States to Kingston to give us today's lecture, and welcome to Queen's Law School.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Renee. Thank you, Mohammed. Thank you, Madam Dean. Thank you all for coming. This is my first time here in Kingston. I walked over. It's such a beautiful campus that you have, a lovely city, and everyone has been just so darn friendly to me. I'm very grateful. When I crossed the border, I actually made a slight mistake in approaching the gate, and the woman was very kind and friendly and didn't throw me in solitary confinement. The signage here has been great. As I'm coming into the outskirts of Kingston, there's this, you know, very friendly sign informing that I can buy cannabis here. Thank you very much. Let the record reflect that I did not accept the offer, but merci bien tout de même. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is an excerpt of a forthcoming book, and the book is the middle in a series that I'm trying to write that aims to be Bluntly, I'm an ambitious person. I'm a kind of the American Blackstone. I'm trying to offer a definitive account of the American constitutional experience. I've tried to write a series of books that are holistic. One, which came out in 2005, America's Constitutional Biography, walks you, the reader, through the written constitution of the United States from start to finish, the preamble, Article 1, 2, 3, all the way through to Article 7 and the amendments. So that tries to be textually holistic. This new project tries to look at the Constitution once again holistically, but in a chronological way, telling you the story of an intergenerational, you the reader, the story of an intergenerational project. A volume one, The Fellowship of the Ring, so to speak, tells the story about how America becomes America, how we, the people of the United States, become a we, the words that made us. It's a pun, US. And that tells the story from 1760 to 1840. And at the beginning of that story, America isn't a thing, it's an assortment. But by the end of volume one, America has become a thing. This is I'm going to read to you an excerpt from volume two. It's coming out in September. And it's entitled Born Equal: Remaking America's Constitution, 1840 to 1920. So we begin this book with slavery in many parts of the United States. Millions of people in chains. And we travel through a civil war and a series of constitutional amendments that will end slavery, promise birthright, American citizenship, equal voting rights eventually for blacks and women. So we end with women's suffrage in 1920. And that and the main theme of this middle a book in the series, that the Two Towers, so to speak, if you're a Tolkien fan, as am I, is birth equality. And then the third volume, which I've begun, will take the story from 1920 to the present moment, and it's tentatively entitled Earth's Best Hope, America's Constitution, 1920 to the present. Now, I wrote these passages long ago, before the most recent election, but there may be certain parts that seem eerily prescient to you. We'll see. So, as you've heard from my friend Muhammad, the title of this is The U.S. Constitution as the Law of the Land, Maps, Militaries, and the Mississippi. From California to the New York Island, in redwood forests and by Gulf Stream waters, amid diamond deserts, and along waving wheat fields, millions of 20th century and 21st century Americans have proudly sung that this land was made for you and me. That's a Woody Guthrie song. When and how was it made? Legally, politically, militarily, and diplomatically, who made this land and why? In particular, why did founding era and antebellum era statesmen tightly bundle modern day South Carolina, Virginia, New York, Massachusetts, Maine, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Montana, Washington, California, Arizona, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, and almost all places in between into one indivisible nation, one land? To answer these questions, we shall begin in the spirit of Woody Guthrie's iconic folk song by pondering this land itself, its overall size and shape, its proximity to and distance from other lands, its adjoining oceans, its beaches, bays, and borders, its mountains, valleys, and plains, its forests, fields, and deserts, its soils, stones, and precious metals, its temperature and rainfall, its watersheds and drainage basins, and its highways and waterways, both natural and man-made. This land called America did not always have the basic legal and political shape that it now does. As historical maps dramatized, the nation's boundaries in the 1830s through the 1850s were especially fluid, deeply contestable, and in fact, sharply contested, legally, politically, morally, diplomatically, and militarily. The current shape of the United States was thus far from predestined, much less manifestly predestined. So we can just, I'll just give you a sneak preview of some of the maps. And I'll tell you a little bit more about each of them. This one, the top one, is 1830. This is 1839. These are historical maps. This one's 1851. This one's 1856. And this one is the same period, but it's about, it shows you watersheds rather than man-made borders. So that's what we're going to talk about today, how the basic shape of the American landmass emerged. As late as 1844, America looked remarkably different than it does today. Okay, so let's look at this. So that's basically 1839 to, hold on, color plate do I want here? Yeah, color plate three. So that's America circa 1839, but also circa 1844. Yet its contours back then were workable, militarily defensible, diplomatically supportable, democratically sustainable, demographically practicable, and commercially viable. The population centers now known as Houston and Austin were no part of this 1844 America. Rather, these then villages were pieces of the independent Lone Star Republic of Texas. Today's San Francisco Bay Area, Big Sur, Yosemite Valley, and Mount Shasta, glittering jewels of modern California, likewise lay beyond the boundaries of the United States. These and countless other gems belonged to Mexico. Then came an extraordinary concatenation of ironic and far from inevitable developments over the course of a quarter century. Led by a slaveholding expansionist, James K. Polk, Americans forcibly shoved the nation's borders outward, though they failed to get the frontiers that Polk and many other expansionists truly wanted. They lusted for Tampico and the Sierra Madre, but had to settle for Taos and the Sierra Nevada. The United States of America began as a military arrangement, a geography-driven alliance of convenience among 13 smallish and previously separate mainland British colonies. In 1776, these 13 provinces, although legally distinct and culturally dissimilar, especially on slavery-related issues, had to join or die. And this is a famous cartoon by Benjamin Franklin, well, it's a sort of divided stake. And it's the world's first cartoon, political cartoon, first viral meme, three words, join or die. Only a united military and diplomatic effort could defeat America's British overlords and win independence for all 13, whose combined free population amounted to roughly a sixth of Greater Britain's, including Ireland. In 1787 to 88, Americans retooled their fledgling union and committed themselves to a legally indivisible continental system. Once again, geography and military necessity compelled them to unite, this time far more tightly and permanently via a legal marriage if you prefer, prohibiting any subsequent unilateral dissolution. During a year-long experience in which Americans up and down the continent intensely debated the proposed Constitution, no leading Federalist and no state ratifying convention, not one, ever embraced any legal right of unilateral secession. Rather, Continentalists such as George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison loudly and repeatedly insisted that the document drafted in Philadelphia meant what it said. Once ratified, the Constitution would be, in the words of the document's emphatic supremacy clause, that's Article 6, quote, the supreme law of the land, unquote, regardless of anything that an individual state might later try to say or do. The word land in this key clause was revealing, for the deep logic underlying the Constitution's supremacy clause and underlying the Constitution more generally was geographic. Each of the 13 original states shared a land border with at least one other state. Each state also occupied a stretch of Atlantic coastline, except perhaps Pennsylvania, whose crown jewel, Philadelphia, was a major Atlantic seaport just a few miles upriver from the shoreline. Were any state to retain a legal right to secede in the future, it could at any moment lawfully opt to open its coast and ports to Britain's military or to the military of any other powerful European monarchy, for that matter. This foreign military could then use the seceding state as a land base for potentially devastating armed aggression against the Union's remaining states. Such aggression could quite imaginably culminate in the complete destruction of America as an independent, self-governing land. By agreeing to the Constitution, the people of each ratifying state relinquished any future legal right to do such a murderous and reprehensible thing. Once these 13 unconditional and interlocking relinquishments snapped into place, the Union government could henceforth and confidently fortify each state against potential European attack. Short of Benedict Arnold-style treason by locals, which would in fact occur in the 1860s, the Union's outward-facing guns in any given state could never be swiveled around and pointed at the bellies of other Americans. No fort in any American state could ever lawfully become a base of European aggression against Americans in nearby states. The father of the new nation, okay, who's the father of the Constitution? Who were you taught? James Madison, right? Ridiculous. James Madison is 5'4". And no one's ever heard of him. Okay. The father of the United States Constitution is, of course, George Washington. And that's defended at great length in the book, The Words That Made Us. But you could confirm this in 5 seconds with the Google machine. If you just looked at historic American newspapers and just put in the phrase father of the Constitution. And before 1820, it would always be George Washington, never James Madison. The father of the new nation, George Washington, was himself a surveyor, planter, real estate investor, land developer, battlefield general, and continental commander-in-chief, with a strong feel for geography and geostrategy. He spent much of his life making and poring over maps. Maps were one of the main tools with which Washington and many other Americans of his time saw their world and made sense of it. Maps of Europe, Asia, and Africa told a remarkable story. Throughout the late 18th century, only two advanced nations outside the Americas, Switzerland and Britain, could claim extant and enduring regimes of freedom and robust self-government. Why these two? Because, as Publius noted in key Federalist essays, these two had defensible borders. Switzerland had inherited, or so it appeared, a God-given rampart, the Great Wall of the Alps. Britain had, seemingly, lucked upon a natural moat, the English Channel. Early American leaders could not replicate the Alps. But if Americans formed a more perfect and indissoluble union, they could create a kind of island nation reminiscent of Britain. Indeed, they could better Britain. America's moat, the 3,000-mile-wide Atlantic Ocean, would hinder potential European naval invasions far more powerfully than could Britain's moat, the 20-mile-wide English Channel. In fact, Britain's moat was not mere luck. It was neither purely God-given nor entirely natural. Rather, it was made, or at least legally perfected and juridified, by flesh and blood politicians and legalists who in the 1700s purposefully forged a perfect union, that's a quote, between the formerly separate and land-bordering kingdoms of England and Scotland. Before the 1707 Act of Union, yeah, that was a different Act of Union, life in England was less free, less self-governing, more monarchical, more militarized, and more precarious, given the chronic possibility of invasion from Scotland, aided perhaps by France. But once a legally perfect British Union was fashioned, that is, made, Britain's North and South could rely primarily on a professional navy that could rule the oceanic waves encircling the British island. Unlike Old England and Old Scotland, post-Union Britain no longer had internal land borders that needed defense via an intimidating army standing along a fraught frontier. Crucially, Publius and other shrewd 18th century observers saw professional navies as less threatening to liberty than professional armies. Navies pose no direct and existential threat to peaceful, self-governing Republican folk in the hinterlands. At worst, an enemy ship could pound a coastline and its key ports. Large armies, by contrast, threatened liberty wherever soldiers stood and wherever they could march, killing, raping, and pillaging as they went. As maps of Europe made clear to American revolutionaries, and just think of Ukraine today, As maps of Europe made clear to American revolutionaries, countries with land borders, especially long land borders, without any natural barrier to invasion, tended toward despotism. Land borders often required large standing armies to guard the frontier, and dictatorial military leaders could easily use these standing armies to kill and cow civilian subjects and threaten domestic liberty. A close reading of America's Constitution and key Federalist essays confirms the centrality of these interrelated ideas about land, water, armies, navies, liberty, England, and Scotland. Article 1 frowned on a standing army while smiling on a standing navy. Only the former required a fresh congressional vote every 2 years. The Second Amendment's ode to the militia likewise reflected anxiety about professional armies, but not professional navies. In the Federalist Number 8, Alexander Hamilton, writing as Publius, stressed that Britain remained free because it was an island protected by a navy. America should emulate Britain, said Publius. And in the Federalist Number 5, John Jay, also posing as Publius, reminded readers that Britain's island nation had in fact been made politically via conscious legal process in the early 1700s that had created, quote, an entire and perfect union, unquote, between England and Scotland. This language set the stage for the Constitution's preamble, whose more perfect union, that's a quote language, aimed to do much the same thing and for much the same reasons in America. Now you're sort of wondering, well, what about to the north? I know you're thinking this. So, yeah. Hang on. The 1787 American Union could never perfectly replicate the 1707 British Union because land borders of some sort seemed unavoidable on America's northern and southern and western flanks. But so long as these borders lay far from America's main population centers, concentrated as these centers were along the Atlantic coast, such borders could accommodate a Britain-emulating and liberty-loving Republican regime relying on professional sailors and local amateur militias for homeland security while disdaining large standing armies. America's 1776 footprint worked well geostrategically. Dense forests guarded the northern and eastern edges of Massachusetts's rural district of Maine, which bordered British Nova Scotia. British armies could not easily sweep across this rugged terrain to threaten coastal hubs such as Falmouth, modern-day Portland, Portsmouth, or Boston. Rather, seafaring British warships would need to set sail from Halifax, the West Indies, or London. Likewise, Georgia's southern marshes and forests shielded America from land-based invasion from the sparsely populated British provinces of East and West Florida further south. Nor could Britain easily threaten America's coastal strongholds from the new nation's northwestern back country. So that would be Kingston. any Quebec-based, Kingston-based, or Ontario-based invading army would need to slog hundreds of miles through woods and wetlands. Thin and stretched British supply lines would offer America's trained soldiers, bolstered by local militias and support of patriot homesteads, tempting targets for counterattack, as dramatized by the rebels' first big victories in the 1777 battles of Saratoga in upstate New York, not that far from here, 2-3 hours. These dramatic victories, alongside diplomat Benjamin Franklin's prestige and charm in Paris, induced France in 1778 to recognize American sovereignty and independence and to back the colonists with massive infusions of money and materiel. With this French backing, Americans decisively defeated the British on land and sea at Yorktown in 1781, and the British relented. The 1783 Treaty of Paris ended the war by recognizing American independence and redrawing the world map. These two things were inextricably intertwined. Independence was all about maps. Independent America was now a recognized sovereign over a carefully delineated part of the globe. The official borders that Franklin negotiated, aided by John Jay and John Adams, recognized America's claims all the way to the Mississippi River. As part of a comprehensive settlement with various world powers that had jumped into the American conflict as it unfolded, England also relinquished East and West Florida to Spain, which had entered the war in 1779 alongside France, but had not allied directly with America. The Floridas were Spain's consolation prize, and its unrealized dream was the return of Gibraltar, which Britain had wrenched from it in the 1713 Peace of Utrecht, ending the War of Spanish Succession. In the Federalist Number 2, Publius suggestively described independent America as a mini Britain of sorts, surrounded by an aqueous circle. Here's a quote: "A succession of navigable waters forms a kind of chain round its borders, as if to bind it together." As we think about the St. Lawrence and then the Mississippi, the Great Lakes and the Mississippi, but as and then the Atlantic, and the Gulf of America, formerly known as the Gulf of Mexico. But I don't say that in the book. But as Jay knew better than anyone, his alleged chain had a crucial missing link. America did not control the mouth of the Mississippi River, nor did Americans have an ironclad right to transfer cargo from riverboats to seafaring ships, or vice versa, at the Spanish-controlled mouth, New Orleans, in a province then known as West Florida. In 1786, diplomat Jay had rashly offered Spain a deal in which trans-Appalachian Americans would forego navigation to and through the Mississippi's mouth for 25 years. The deal ultimately collapsed, but nonetheless enraged backcountry folk, especially in Kentucky and in Franklin, which is part of modern-day Tennessee. It was called Franklin back then. The river was frontier America's lifeline. In 1803, President Thomas Jefferson made Jay Publius an honest man in retrospect by completing the water chain and purchasing the lower Mississippi all the way to the ocean from France. Spain had recently transferred this region to Napoleon, who needed money to finance his vast armies and aggressive land wars in Europe. Jefferson saw that New Orleans was the key to the continent. This is a quote: "There is on the globe," he wrote in 1802 to his minister to France, "one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market, and from its fertility will before long yield more than half of our whole produce and contain more than half of our inhabitants." As Lincoln, not yet born, might have humorously put the point, Jefferson in 1802 was in effect saying that he hoped to have God on his side, but he must have New Orleans. Napoleon, in turn, had to have money to finance his bloated European armies and deadly wars of conquest. The continental European strongman thus proved willing to sell off not just the key port city at the mouth of the mighty Mississippi, and not just the historic province of which it was a part, West Florida, but also all of France's remaining Louisiana lands, encompassing the river's western watershed, stretching as far as north as modern-day Canada, and as far west as the crest of the Rocky Mountains. With one magnificent land and water deal, Jefferson had doubled the size of this land. He had also secured, as he well understood, vast tracts of especially fertile bottomland. This is a long quote, whose warm and rich soils contrasted with the cold, stony ground of New England and the tobacco-depleted dirt of old Virginia. Then came Andrew Jackson, following the footsteps of Washington and Jefferson. First, in the spirit of Washington's 1781 victory at Yorktown, Jackson decisively beat the British in the 1815 Battle of New Orleans. Then, in the spirit of Jefferson's 1803 purchase of Louisiana, Jackson pried East Florida from old Europe, wresting control of the peninsula in 1816. 3 years later, President James Monroe and the Senate diplomatically codified this land grab via the 1819 Adams-Onís Treaty with Spain, an accord negotiated by Monroe's hardworking Secretary of State and eventual successor, John Quincy Adams. As independent America celebrated its 50th birthday in July 1826, the Declaration's project seemed a smashing success in many respects. The 13 original colonies remained free and independent states, and were now reaping substantial benefits from a tight juridical and geostrategic system, Washington's Constitution, that had brilliantly preserved and strengthened America's continental freedom and independence from old world monarchs and militaries. The 1787-88 making of a more perfect union, that's a quote, had enabled a common defense, that's another preamble quote, which in turn had secured the blessings of liberty, that's yet another preamble quote, for a free, non-tribal, we the people, that's another preamble quote, and their free, non-enslaved posterity, that's another preamble quote, precisely as promised by the Constitution's preamble. So, you know, here's what it's all about. Just one sentence, the preamble, but it's about, and just to repeat, a more perfect union that's going to create common defense and lead to the blessings of liberty for we the people and our posterity. And certain folks are excluded from the people, the First Nations and enslaved Blacks. Thuggish armies, military dictatorships, hereditary autocracies, wars, coups, imperial authoritarianism, terror, bloodshed, chaos, censorship, and or religious absolutism plagued or would soon plague much of Mexico, the Caribbean, South America, Africa, Asia, and Europe. By contrast, America was generally peaceful and prosperous, free and self-governing. It was a land of regular elections, broad political participation, including jury service, peaceful transfers of power, orderly courtrooms, unrivaled newspaper circulation, robust entrepreneurship, brisk technological innovation, burgeoning centers of learning, and considerable religious freedom. It had no large standing armies in peacetime. Relatively few Americans, other than Revolutionary War loyalists, had fled their native country for greener pastures abroad. That would be here. But, you know, and when I saw the Loyalist Highway, I noticed these things as I, you know, I drove in. In the other direction, free folk from around the globe were starting to stream into the United States. In its first half century, independent America's free, non-tribal population more than quadrupled. 11 new states joined the Union on an equal footing with the 13 originals. Many more future states girded the horizon, thanks especially to the 1781 Battle of Yorktown, the 1783 Treaty of Paris, the 1794 Battle of Fallen Timbers, which defeated Native Americans, the 1795 Jay Treaty with England, the 1796 Pinckney Treaty with Spain, the 1803 Louisiana Purchase from France, the 1813 Battle of the Thames, that's a little closer to home here, the 1815 Battle of New Orleans, and the 1819 Adams O'Neill Treaty. These military and diplomatic triumphs owed a special debt to the five best-known members of the Second Continental Congress, which had birthed the Declaration back in 1776. Consider first George Washington, one of the Second Congress's two most famous attendees, alongside Benjamin Franklin. Although the congressionally deputized general had neither drafted nor signed the Declaration, he had immediately ordered that its terse text be read aloud to his troops, so that the men would know what they were fighting for. He had then risked his life alongside them, and thus for the Declaration, at every turn. More than anyone else, he won the war and achieved the Declaration's primary and avowed goal, American independence. Later, all set for now, if we want to go back to some of these images?
Yeah.
We'll do it soon enough. Okay. We don't need to do it for a while. Thanks. More than anyone else, Washington won the war and achieved an avowed goal, American independence. Later, as America's first president, he opened up the West to American settlement, first by defeating Britain's Indian allies at the Battle of Fallen Timbers in modern-day Ohio, and then by striking pacifying treaties with both the British, Jay's Treaty, and the Spanish, Pinckney's Treaty. Pinckney's Treaty tasted particularly sweet, guaranteeing a strongly united America navigation access to and through the Mississippi's mouth, including a right of cargo deposit in New Orleans, the very things that diplomat Jay and a weakly United America had failed to win before Washington's Constitution clicked into place. More than anyone else, Washington's famed colleague, Benjamin Franklin, won the peace and backcountry land aplenty at the diplomatic bargaining table in Paris. As John Trumbull would later highlight in one of his four U.S. Capitol Rotunda tableau, Franklin had helped draft the Declaration in the summer of 1776. So had John Adams, who later flanked Franklin at Paris to push for the best deal possible at the treaty table. In the late 1790s, Adams, as America's president, backed Haitian slave rebels against Haiti's French overlords. This slave revolt chastened Napoleon, prompting him to cut his New World losses by selling off his remaining North American holdings to Jefferson. Another declarationist who closed the deal with the assistance of yet another man front and center in Trumbull's Rotunda Tableau, Robert R. Livingston. In July 1776, New York's Livingston was one of the five members of the key Declaration Drafting Committee alongside Virginia's Jefferson, Massachusetts's Adams, and Pennsylvania's Franklin, Connecticut's Roger Sherman, guy from New Haven's mayor, by the way, was the fifth member. In 1802-1803, Livingston was Jefferson's main man in Paris, inking the Louisiana Purchase. In tandem, then, America's great founders and great founding documents, the Declaration of 1776, the Constitution of 1787, were aging well at the Declaration's mid-century mark, that is 1826. Slavery was the enormous exception to young Americans' otherwise strong performance. True, states north of the Mason and Dixon line had either ended slavery outright or put it on a guaranteed path of elimination. And by the way, they did so way before Canada, the proto-Canada. And these states had done so in harmony with northern state constitutions that in general closely tracked the Declaration's soaring language of birth equality and inalienable rights. So the North is getting rid of slavery immediately, beginning 1776. But states south of Pennsylvania had yet to follow this lead, and the Constitution had myopically failed to induce or oblige slavery's ultimate extinction. Against this background, then, let us ponder a standard map of America, circa 1830. So that's the first one. Let's just go back to that. It's the top one. That's 1830. America's 1830 footprint was remarkably different from its modern day outline. There was no Texas, no California, and nothing in between the two. Yet the 1830 map reflected a workable set of legal partitions. America's land borders were defensible, and the juridical lines governing North America's main waterways likewise made good sense. 19th century land travel could be excruciatingly difficult and expensive. Cargo and people could often move most easily and cheaply by floating, sailing across an ocean or down a river, or even powering up a river or a canal, either by oars, paddles, poles, ropes, topaz, mules, locks, sails, wind, and steam. In 1830, America controlled virtually the entire watershed of the Mississippi, from its mouth to its sources in every direction. The most strategically important exception lay in a thin sliver of northern Texas that drained into the Red River, which formed the border between the United States and Mexico. So see the bottom plate here, and you see how it corresponds pretty darn well to the map of 1830 America. And if you want to take a look, the bottom one is modern water flows. And if you want to look at watersheds, this is a watershed map. There's only one teeny, teeny, tiny sliver of the Mississippi watershed that's not in the United States. It's above modern day Montana. It's just that little rectangle up there in, I guess that would be, Alberta or something. But that's it for the entire watershed of the mighty Mississippi. But a little bit of modern day Texas, you see, is below the watershed, and so that's going to be a bit of an issue. The watershed boundary. The Mississippi River and its tributaries were antebellum America's life-sustaining arterial system. Let me go back to CC. Just how important the Mississippi is. And this, you see, should be deeply comforting to you because it's not in Canada. We don't need it. We're perfectly fine, you know, without Canadian land, but we must have New Orleans. You see, okay. The Mississippi River and its tributaries were antebellum America's life-sustaining arterial system, the nation's essential transportation spine, the indispensable conduit of commerce and communication in the heartland. I love this quote. In 1829, President Jackson told then Secretary of State and future handpicked successor, Martin Van Buren, that, quote, "the God of the universe has intended this great valley to belong to one nation," unquote. In 1830, Americans thus had enough good land and enough good water and in the right places with no worrisome internal impediments or looming external threats. Americans east of the Appalachians had excellent access to the Atlantic. Americans west of the Appalachians had good access to the Mississippi and its major tributaries in all directions. Threading through the Mohawk Valley Gap in the Appalachian Range between the Catskills and the Adirondacks, the recently completed Erie Canal nicely linked Americans' eastern and western water systems, enabling people and cargo to float inland from Manhattan to Albany to Buffalo to Chicago to New Orleans or vice versa. True, a few frontiers circa 1830 needed tidying up and would in fact soon be tidied up by a pair of Anglo-American treaties. The northern Maine border was unclear, and Britain and America had not yet agreed how to partition a large and sparsely populated Pacific Northwest region, but the two nations were then jointly occupied. So you see, you know, that in, you know, the red that extends into modern day BC. In 1842, the Webster-Ashburton Treaty would settle the Maine line, and in 1846, American Britain would divide the Northwest by extending to the Pacific the existing 49th parallel border between the United States and British North America. On America's southern flank, the international borders in place in 1830 closely tracked a relatively clean division between America's main waterways on the one hand and Northwest Mexico's on the other. And that's why, you know, just you compare these two color plates and the similarity just seems remarkable to me, the kind of the watershed's division. The similarities between these two schemas are striking. Okay. From source to mouth, America generally controlled the rivers feeding into the Gulf. I wrote this a long time ago. I just said the Gulf. Of what? Okay. America generally controlled the rivers feeding into Gulf and Atlantic harbors from New Orleans through New England, plus most of the Columbia/Snake River watershed in the Pacific Northwest, flowing past modern-day Portland to the seaside settlement of Astoria. Jefferson and other utopians had once dreamed of a Mississippi, Missouri, and the Columbian Snake River systems might easily connect via Northwest Passage portage route that explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark were sent to discover and map in the early 1800s. But it turns out it's not so easy to connect those two river systems. In turn, Mexico in 1830 generally controlled the Colorado River watershed and various river systems south of the Red River, an important waterway that today forms the border between Oklahoma and Texas. America in 1830 did not imperiously need Texas, or California for that matter. I grew up in California, both of which were then comfortably part of northern Mexico. So what happened? Why did America's southern and western border shift so dramatically between 1830 and 1855? And I'm going to skip a whole bunch where I tell you why that happened. Slavery turns out to be a part of the story. Oh, and there's gold in California. So, you know, you put together, you know, slavery and gold and things happen. So you have to read the book for the details. Here's a second section from the book. In early 1837, shortly before handing Martin Van Buren, President Andrew Jackson announced the United States now recognized the Texas Republic's declarationist pretenses to be a free, sovereign, and independent Westphalian nation state. So basically, the northern province of Tejas breaks away from purports to declare its independence from Mexico and purports to create the Lone Star Republic. And it's a slaveholding regime. These are American expatriates who are pro-slavery, and they write their own little Declaration of Independence in 1836. One of the people doing that is a man named Thomas Jefferson Rusk. So it's an interesting document in between the 1776 Declaration and the Confederate declarations in the Southland in 1861. So they purport to be their own independent regime. And in 1837, on his way out, Andrew Jackson recognizes them as an independent Westphalian sovereign. This quick action by Andrew Jackson, a close ally, a fellow Tennessean and now Texan, Sam Houston, was a slap in Mexico's face. Its government still claimed sovereignty over the Texas province and its rebellious residents. No major European power had yet accepted Texas's declaration. Britain, in particular, seethed at the notion that an independent Texas, having just ended slavery in 1833 at great expense to themselves in the nearby Caribbean, Britons hated to see Texas racing in the opposite direction, proudly reintroducing slavery into a professed republic after the Mexican government had formally, if imperfectly, abolished this peculiar institution. So Mexico has ended slavery. Texans revolt and kind of reinstitute slavery. Britain has gotten rid of slavery in the Caribbean. It still has it in the Indian subcontinent. Okay, Ceylon. And if modern day Sri Lanka, and if Texas slave plantations, and if Texas slave plantations in future years ended up producing cotton on a mass scale for a world market more cheaply than British Caribbean manors could using only free labor, this market advantage would add economic insult to moral injury. Jackson's prompt recognition contrasted dramatically with America's treatment of another self-proclaimed New World Republic southeast of Texas. In a ferociously bloody slave revolt, Black Haitians had won their de facto independence from France no later than 1804. France itself recognized the Black-led government of Haiti in 1825. Britain did the same in 1833, but no American president followed suit, and none would do so until Lincoln in 1862. By 1840, American maps of the New World shifted. Here's the new map here. A sizable chunk of the North American continent, a quadrant west of the Sabine River and north of the Nueces River, was now no longer depicted as Northeast Mexico. See, so here, just to remind you, it's Northeast Mexico. And now, that was 1830, 1840, it's this separate thing. Rather, now it's Texas, a new country with its own map color, wedged between the United States and Mexico. The best maps of the late antebellum era were extraordinary technological achievements and educational instruments. A good school teacher could and did use a great atlas to teach pupils not merely geography, but also history, law, math, astronomy, anthropology, and more. Let us then carefully consider the extraordinary map as shown in this color plate. Much of Mitchell's school atlas, that's what this is from, Mitchell's school atlas, published in Philadelphia in 1839. So this map is more than a stunning work of art and science, though surely that. It was also a political, legal, and diplomatic document of sorts. It awarded sovereign status to Texas, that's in all caps, in conformity with the formal juridical stance of the United States in the late 1830s, even though most of the other world powers had yet to recognize Texas as a true nation state. The map likewise awarded, in its color scheme at least, all of the Northwest region jointly held by Britain and the United States to, well, us. This is written for an American audience, so it's giving it to the U.S., and there's a pun on U.S. and us. Americans seeing the world through the lens of this map would likely be more inclined to holler 54-40 or fight in the years ahead than if the map were shaded differently. Americans would eventually settle for much less in the Oregon Treaty of 1846, which drew the border at the 49th parallel, nearly 400 miles shy of the 5440 line. Though this accord gave President Polk with less than he had hoped for, and that his loudest expansionist backers had clamored for, it freed him to concentrate his energies and his military on Mexico without fear of becoming embroiled in a two-front war against multiple enemies. The 1839 Mitchell map included the names and locations of various Native American tribes, but not in capital letters, which the map reserved for full sovereigns. As depicted here, tribes such as the Sioux and the Pawnee, if you look at carefully, you'll see the words Sioux and Pawnee, had no formal international law borders, no distinct international law colors. Though many tribes were treaty partners of the United States, America generally forbade these tribes from treating with any other Westphalian nation. And in turn, the other major Westphalian nations generally abided by this American edict. Thus, America's indigenous tribes were not in 1840, nor would they later become full Westphalian sovereigns. So they don't sit in the United Nations today, for example. These juridical facts mattered hugely in pre-1840 American history and would matter even more hugely in ensuing decades. No 1840s reader who saw the world through a map such as this one could miss the significance of international frontiers. These frontiers literally shaped the world, or at least shaped how map makers and map readers imagined and experienced the world. Consider also how Mitchell's 1839 map depicted and analyzed land and water of various sorts. In both its drawing and its legend slash explanatory notes, and I'm almost done here, by the way, the Atlas proudly stressed the astonishing length of the Mississippi. You see, there's all sorts of information here about the length of the Mississippi and other things. As at more than 4,000 miles, was one of the world's longest riparian systems. Unlike the Nile and the Amazon, the Mississippi lay almost entirely within the boundaries of a single nation. Building on the Mississippi River nationalism of Democrats Andrew Jackson and Stephen Douglas and Whig Daniel Webster, among many others, Republican Abraham Lincoln would repeatedly emphasize this key Mississippi River fact in explaining his resolute rejection of attempted secession. Whereas the Mississippi River's long liquid spine in America's heartland was a great national boon, so too, the Atlas hinted, was a short land neck far from America's southern border. Only 36 miles separated the Atlantic and Pacific, the Isthmus of Panama, the Atlas pointed inward. Might this thin neck become important in future years? So if you look right here, you know, in the map, it actually says, Yes. So right here, it just says 36 miles. Okay, there. So they're right there. They're actually 36 months is what it says there. So they're thinking about this stuff. Remember, I wrote this a long time ago, okay? Years ago. When Congress assembled, okay, so then they asked just, might this next, of course, in volume three, I'm going to tell you about, you know, all sorts of stuff in the modern era. Okay, last little segment. This is, now flash forward again. Now we're in the middle of the Civil War. When Congress assembled, on December 1st, 1862, to commence a new annual session, President Abraham Lincoln had much to communicate to his fellow citizens in the legislature. Most of the message elaborated those ideas about secession and slavery. On secession, he reiterated verbatim his inaugural address language about how, unlike an unhappily married couple, the North and the South could not physically separate. But of course, so he says, like, we're stuck with each other. We gotta, you know, be one nation. But of course, borders between separate countries punctuated the planet. If Lincoln could abide a border between the United States and British lands to the north, and I assure you he could, okay, and a border between the United States and Mexico to the south, and I assure you he could, then why not a border between, say, Illinois and Kentucky, or between Kentucky and Tennessee? Part of Lincoln's answer had always been originalist. He was an originalist. He believed in original intent stuff and remained so. Americans in all the states in the founding had agreed in the Constitution to an indivisible union, Canada and Mexico had never agreed to join this project. The Lone Star Republic of Texas, for its part, had agreed to join the project in the 1840s with full knowledge of the Union's indivisibility. Okay, so there's that. As a young man, Abe had traveled down the Mississippi River to its mouth in Louisiana and then back up to Illinois. He had also traveled along some of its major eastern and western feeders. By the way, he understands this better than anyone, because he comes from that part of the world where all the feeders come together. This is the Tennessee River, this is the Cumberland River, this is the Ohio River, this is the Wabash, the Illinois, the Upper Missouri, the Upper Mississippi, Missouri. They all come together, basically, in central and southern Illinois, which is where he was from, and he's also from, you know, Kentucky on the other side. So that's where he comes from. With the confluence of these great rivers come together. He had also traveled along some of its major eastern and western feeders. Indelibly shaped by these early experiences, he now added a powerful geographic twist to his initial presidential pronouncements, a grand meditation on the law of the land. Moving beyond his more abstract inaugural address, he placed explicit and extended emphasis on his own home base in the Midwest and its arterial lifeline, the Mississippi River. This is his quote. "That portion of the Earth's surface, which is owned and inhabited by the people of the United States, is well adapted to be the home of one national family, and it is not well adapted for two or more. The great interior region, bounded east by the Alleghenies, north by the British Dominions," that would be you all, "west by the Rocky Mountains, and south by the line along which the culture of corn and cotton meets, and which includes part of Virginia, part of Tennessee, all of Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Minnesota, and the territories of Dakota, Nebraska, and part of Colorado, already has above 10 million people, and will have 50 million within 50 years if not prevented by any political folly or mistake. It contains more than a third of the country owned by the United States, certainly more than a million square miles. And yet this region has no sea coast, touches no ocean anywhere. As part of one nation, its people now find and may forever find their way to Europe by New York, to South America," and that's, you know, the Erie Canal, Chicago, the Great Lakes, down the Niagara and the Erie Canal, "to South America and Africa by New Orleans," that's the Mississippi, "and to Asia by San Francisco." Remember, he's building a transcontinental railroad. "But separate our common country into two nations, and every man of this great interior region is thereby cut off from some one or more of these outlets, not perhaps by a physical barrier, but by embarrassing and onerous trade regulations." That would be tariffs. "These outlets, east, west, and south, are indispensable to the well-being of the people inhabiting and to inhabit this vast interior region. True to themselves, they will never ask where a line of separation shall be, but will vow rather that there shall be no such line." Last paragraph. Strikingly, in Lincoln's prose, America's land itself becomes metaphorically a human actor with its own needs and demands. Quote, "Our national strife springs not from the land we inhabit, not from our national homestead. There is no possible severing of this land, but would multiply and not mitigate evils among us. In all its adaptations and aptitudes, it," that is the land itself, quote, "demands union and abhors separation."